Hello, and welcome to Paleocast. I'm Joe.
And I'm Dave.
How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing all right, thank you. How are you, Joe?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks.
It's been a while since you've been on.
Yes, I've been busy here in Bristol and at the Natural History Museum.
Ah, right, okay. Well, I've been busy at the Natural History Museum too. It's where I recorded this interview with Dr. Giles Miller, who's a senior curator of micropaleontology there.
So it's quite apt that we should be talking about micropaleontology.
Yes, because there's a beautiful story of how we met and how Paleocast came into existence.
You make it sound like a cheesy romance.
It was a cheesy romance. Don't try and deny it.
So we were both working for a stratigraphy firm that used micropaleontologists, and we were both working as micropaleontologists. When we first met and first outlined the ideas for Paleocast and started to bring our ideas together and sort of get the ball rolling.
Yeah, we used to work pretty much facing each other on opposing desks. And we did a bit too much talking, I think.
On the naughty side of the office.
We were on the naughty side.
Needless to say, neither of us work there.
I don't know if we can say this. I think this is going to be entirely detrimental to my job search at the moment.
So what have you been talking to Giles Miller about?
Well, we really wanted to give an introduction as to what micropaleontology is, so kind of what constitutes a microfossil. Is it just anything below a certain size? Is it any particular group of organisms? And what kind of things they can be used for? So micropaleontology is really a vast, vast subject, and so we're not able to cover much of it in any great detail at this point.
Yeah, and we'll revisit microfossils, I'm sure, at numerous times, because they're some of the most beautiful and interesting fossils. And please look at the pictures on the website, because you'll see what I mean. They're just the most amazing structures. So get your picking brushes at the ready.
So I'm here at the Natural History Museum, and we're joined today by Dr. Giles Miller, who's a senior curator of micropaleontology. So could we just first of all establish what a microfossil actually is? Is it just anything below a certain size?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. It's harder to answer than you'd imagine, because some people have different ideas of what is a microfossil. Some people say below a particular size. So for example, a small snail or a small part of a fish could be classed as a microfossil. But here in the museum, we're very much, the collections are arranged taxonomically. So we would follow generally the terms that the Micropaleontological Society would use. So we would use things that are either foraminifera, ostracods, radiolaria, or siliceous microfossils, such as diatoms, and then covering the whole of the range of palynology. So we'd be classifying things, so that could include pollen and spores, it could be oceanic plankton. So in terms of the arrangements of the collections here, we wouldn't be including things like small gastropods or small parts of fish. They would be in the mollusk sections or in the fish sections. But in terms of size, there's no size beyond which something starts being a large fossil and becomes a small fossil. Because some of the things we have in our collections here, some of the foraminifera are up to about 5 centimetres in size. And because they're classified under the animal which creates them, or actually the single cell that creates them, we classify them within the microfossil group, even though they obtain a large size. So there's no particular size which something starts becoming a microfossil. We have the same problem with what is a fossil. I mean, it's probably could be a subject of one of your future paleocasts, but where does the cutoff actually occur? Some people would say 10,000 years, but that's a completely arbitrary figure, and there's no agreement beyond which something is recently dead and something is fossil. Also, you get things, for example, we just took on a pollen and spore collection, which is from the botany department, the former botany department here. And you could say that that shouldn't be in paleontology because it's all derived from recent plants, but those particular specimens also relate to things that you find in the fossil record, going back to about 2.5 million years, covering the whole of the Quaternary. So there's no real sort of clear line of cutoff when something stops becoming something which is recently dead and starts becoming a fossil.
So it's just the group of animals rather than the specific size.
In the museum, that's the definition that we would hold, but only because that's the way we arrange our collections here in the museum. Okay.
And you said that they can get up to 5 centimetres, which is pretty big for what you said is a single cell as well. How small can they get?
Well, the smallest we get down to sort of nanometres.
Okay.
These are the sort of nanofossils, things like coccolithophores. And we have both fossil and recent coccolithophores again in our collections. A former member of staff, Jeremy Young, has built up an enormous collection.
So I'm just trying to think about how big a nanometer actually is.
So that's if you're talking millimeters, a micrometer is 0.001 of a millimeter,
right.
And a nanometer is 0.001 of a micrometer.
So really, pretty small then.
Yeah. Okay. And you can only see them using a scanning electron microscope. And occasionally you can use optical techniques to see them under a microscope.
So we touched on a couple of the groups then of microfossils, foraminifera, radiolaria, diatoms, that lot. Are they animals or are they plants or are they something completely different altogether?
They can be both. And for example, the coccolithophores I mentioned, they're plants, and the pollen and spores obviously are derived from plants, and the algae that you find, the planktonic algae that you find in rocks from the oceans, they're derived from plants as well. Whereas the majority, for example, the foraminifera that I mentioned, they go up to 5 centimetres, they're a single celled, an animal cell. But we also have metazoans, things like the ostracods, which are classified with the crustaceans.
Okay, so these are just, so you can have things that are pretty similar sized, and one is just a single cell, and the other one, well, a giant single cell, and one is just a tiny, tiny little crustacean, and yet they're the same size.
They vary. I mean, you can find, when I mentioned the single cell, I mean, it's that the single cell secretes a shell or a test, which can be quite large. So if you're looking at the single cell, that is pretty microscopic, but the shell that it secretes is you could see it under a microscope quite easily. If I sprinkle some on my desk, you could probably see them, probably say they were grains of sand, but there's sort of a range of different sizes, some of which you can see with a naked eye and some of which you need a scanning electron microscope to see.
So with so many different groups of animals and plants, is it better to think of micropaleontology as an umbrella in which the study of all of these separate groups come under?
Oh, very much so. I think I always have a bit of a chuckle when people introduce me as an expert in micropaleontology, because there are so many, as I mentioned, all the different types of fossil groups. And even within those groups, they span sometimes the entire geological record. So experts would have a particular area that they would be interested in. For example, I work on conodonts, so I would say most experts on conodonts would be either a Silurian or an Ordovician or a Devonian. So even within these different eras, there are real specialisms within those. So it is an absolutely enormous subject, covering a whole various different aspects and pretty much the whole of the geological column.
How many species are there approximately in every group? Are there thousands?
Millions?
Or is it pretty hard to say?
It's very difficult to tell. I mean, looking at the Ellison Messenia catalogue, which is a catalogue of fossil foraminiferal names, I think we got to, there are about 45 or 46,000 different species names in that catalogue. But I've been using that catalogue and looking at our collections, and there are actually quite a few species mentioned in our collections that aren't on that list of names. So we're talking probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of different species, just not of the form, just of the foraminifera. But it's quite a difficult question to answer. And looking at our collections, often you'll find that some of those names may be old names, or they may have been synonymized. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not an answer that people would be able to sort of say for definite. So we're probably talking tens of thousands, but I wouldn't like to be held on that one.
Well, you say that that's with tens of thousands of foraminifera, but they're just the single cell. And if these fossils are representing the skeletons or testes that they secrete, how come there's so much variation when it's just one single cell producing a skeleton? Shouldn't they all just be little balls with a calcareous shell around them?
Well, they live in so many different environments and substrates, conditions, temperature, salinity, that each of them adapts into a particular way for that particular environment. So often we can use the record that we find in the fossil record to reconstruct the environments that they were deposited in.
So how common are they in any given rock?
Well, it varies between the fossil type. I mean, some types of rock, for example, a limestone, if you're looking at Paleozoic material and wanting to find conodonts, you'd be taking samples sometimes at least a kilogram in size. Sometimes there are some workers who take 50 kilogram samples to find a representative portion of those particular taxa. But other groups, for example, the coccoliths, because they're so small, you can almost just scrape off a piece from a rock, put it under a microscope, and then you're having literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of specimens for you to be able to view in one go. Plankton as well, from oceanic plankton, a lot of oceanic rocks, you only need to dissolve up, say, 100 grams, and sometimes even less than that, 10 grams would do, and you're finding the whole assemblage covering as much as you would need, and possibly more sometimes. But it really depends on the environment as well. If you go to an environment perhaps which wasn't so amenable to the particular group that you're looking for, you may find that your samples are completely barren. So it's often a bit of scientific guesswork as to which samples and which areas that you go to and what sort of paleo environments you're looking at to try and get the best amount. So it can vary between anything from nothing to up to literally hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of specimens per sample.
Are there any rocks that are made up entirely of these fossils?
There are. I mean, for example, at the bottom of the ocean, you often find these radiolarian cherts, which are composed almost entirely of the tiny little silica skeletons of radiolarians. And sometimes, for example, if you go to the pyramids in Egypt, you find these rocks composed of the nummulites. I mentioned that some foraminifera can grow up to 5 centimetres in size. These nummulites are little coin-shaped things, right, Imagine the size of perhaps a 10-pence piece. That's a sort of average size for a nummulite in the rocks. And those particular species are named Gizaensis after the pyramids in Egypt.
Oh, it's amazing to think that the pyramids are just made up of these dead foraminifera, essentially.
Yeah, it's a story we quite often tell people, showing them how relevant micropaleontology is to modern day and to things that you can actually see. When in reality, most rocks that you look at will have some sort of microfossil in them. Obviously, igneous rocks and things like that won't have any microfossils in them. But most sedimentary rocks, if you're looking at them, you use the right techniques to get them out, you'll be finding microfossils.
So are many of these groups still around today?
Quite a few of them are, and we can use them. We can, for example, if you go into the oceans and you do a dredge, you'll find lots of coccoliths, you'll probably find lots of planktonic foraminifera. You can also dredge the bottom of the ocean and find various forms, also of ostracods and various other planktonic organisms which have died and sunk to the bottom, radiolarians, for example. So there are quite a few that we can look at the biology of the living animals and then use that to try and compare back and look at the fossil material that we're finding in the fossil record. But there are others, for example, the conodonts, and we don't really know. There's nothing, the closest living relatives there are things like hagfishes and lampreys. But obviously there are slight differences, and they became extinct at the end of the Triassic. So we don't always have that luxury of being able to use the modern record to interpret the past.
So what can these microfossils tell us about ancient environments?
Well, because they're so restricted, and there are some groups which are particularly influenced by environmental conditions, we can study them in the modern day and use those as proxies to look back into the fossil record. For example, we have a modern pollen spore collection here. So you might say, why is that in the paleontology department? But those pollen spores are present in the fossil record covering the whole of the Quaternary. So we can use the conditions or the distribution of those particular taxa in the present day to try and interpret back and use those to work out the environmental conditions over the last 2.5 million years. We can also use things like planktonic foraminifera and their distribution in sediments. And we can look at the same species present today and look at how those are distributed in the fossil record. Sometimes we can also use them to date or age rocks as well, because the changes through time are quite considerable, and we can pinpoint particular geological horizons based on the microfossils that they contain.
Could you give us an example of how microfossils can be used to work out paleoclimates?
Well, a really nice example associated with work going on at the Natural History Museum is work going on with the AHOB project, which is the Ancient Human Occupation of Britain. There have been various major finds over the last 10 to 15 years of early human remains in the UK. And as part of those works, people have been looking for both pollen and spores, but also foraminifera and ostracods. And they've been looking at the distribution of those through the sediments where these finds have occurred. So they've been able to interpret both the levels where the finds have been recovered, but also the sediments above and below. They've been able to tell us something about the climate and also the environment where the particular beds or the levels of the fossils have occurred. This has been really useful in reconstructing the climate over that time, but also giving us a context of how those particular humans lived at the time. And also, for example, a lot of the ostracods that were discovered next to the oldest human occupants in Britain were discovered from an estuarine environment. And it's interpreted that they lived on the banks of the proto River Thames in East Anglia at that time. So they can be, as well as being a research tool on their own, they can also support all sorts of different research projects, not just on ancient humans, but in any other fossil group. It's quite interesting. Recently, we merged paleontology and mineralogy together, and we were looking at ways in which the two departments could cross over. And micropaleontology was one of the key ways that we could tie in both the work of the mineralogists, the environmental and economic mineralogists, and also the work of going on in the paleontology department. So micropaleontology is an extremely applicable and widely ranging subject on itself.
How far back in the fossil record can you go? Is it just pretty recent? Or can you go right back to the Precambrian?
Well, if you look at organic remains, if you use horrible, nasty acids to dissolve up rocks from the Precambrian, you do occasionally find remains of these organic materials called acrotarchs, and they're just small pieces of oceanic plankton. We do have some of those in our collections here at the museum. But we cover the whole range of the fossil record, and quite a few of the fossil groups cover pretty much the whole of the fossil record.
So you mentioned about dating rocks, and this is, I know from experience, unfortunately, called biostratigraphy. But could you tell us all what that actually is?
Well, biostratigraphy is effectively using the biological contents of the rocks, usually fossils, and in this case, microfossils, to date and age rocks and to use to work out their stratigraphic relationship to other rocks. And this can be used in a context, could be used in oil companies usually, to build up an idea of the geological history of a particular rock basin. Or it could be used simply to support other works. I mentioned previously the work on the ancient human occupation of Britain project. The microfossils can be used to date the finds. There are other examples, for example, in dinosaurs, we could use sometimes occasionally the microfossils associated with dinosaur finds to date those particular remains. So that it's quite an applicable thing, not just to the oil industry, but across the board in paleontology.
So what makes microfossils particularly good for biostratigraphy?
Well, the first thing is their abundance. As I mentioned before, just one piece of rock, sometimes as small as 10 grams, can produce you some really amazing and important remains which can help you to date and age the rocks. So imagine if you're drilling a borehole and you're looking for larger fossils, the chances of it going through one of those fossils and finding a complete specimen which will allow you to age a rock is quite low. Whereas if you're looking for microfossils, you only need a small piece. In fact, often it's just the chips which come up from the bottom of a borehole can tell you enough information to date and age those rocks. The second thing is that the taxa on which the ages are based, they change quite considerably through time. Obviously, there are some taxa, there are always long-ranging taxa, which are not so useful because they occur over a long period of geological time. But there are always key taxa that you can try and find in your particular sample, which will give you a pretty good date or age of the rock. And in some geological sections, there are particular zones. For example, you have foraminiferal zones in the Oligocene, planktonic foraminiferal zones, which can tell you a pretty detailed level that you're finding a particular fossil group from. So both their abundance and also the rapid changes in the fossil record through time can make them particularly useful for biostratigraphy.
So it's the quicker the evolution of a lineage, the more accurately you can assign an age.
That's right.
Yeah.
Although you'd probably be looking to use several different, you could be using microfossils and other fossil groups, or you'd be using different criteria to help you to date that particular level. So you wouldn't be just using one microfossil, you may be using an assemblage of different microfossils to give you an idea to tie it down to a particular age. And they could include long-ranging ones or short-ranging ones.
So if you can get thousands of fossils in just a small amount of material, does it take a long time to actually get through all of these fossils and get a good profile of the overall assemblage that you've got in there and the relative abundances of each species? I imagine it'd be quite fiddly to do all that.
Well, it really depends what you're trying to do, and also the type of fossil you're looking for. If you're looking for a palynomorph, it may be that you have to take a bit longer to process it. You'll have to use a nasty acid in a lab and produce slides and then look through those slides to find an assemblage. But there are other fossil groups, and particular rocks, mud rocks, for example, where you can just put it into a sink and sieve it, and you can pretty much get something you can be looking at within a couple of minutes. Whereas my fossil group, the conodonts, you have to dissolve up limestones usually in acetic acid, and that can take weeks rather than a number of hours to do. And others, you can just scrape a piece off onto a slide and you've pretty much instantly got something that you can be looking at. But analysing the assemblage, it depends what you're looking to do. If you're looking for if you're working for an oil company, you might want a quick date, in which case you might see one specimen in your assemblage and you can go away and say, okay, I've got a date for that particular sample. But if you were writing a paper for a scientific publication, you'd have to spend a bit more time going through the assemblage. You might be documenting all the different species you're finding on a particular slide. And that might take you a bit longer, really depending on what you're planning to do. If you're using that to interpret the environment, you'd be needing to look at all the different fossils within that particular assemblage. So it can be quite quick, it can be quite short, depending on the group and also what you're trying to do. So what imaging techniques do you use to actually view them? Do you use I know you said scanning electron microscopes, but that's just for the smallest of the small. What would you use for just a normal sized microfossil?
For everyday work, you'd just be not using a normal binocular microscope. But again, it would depend what sort of fossil you're looking at. If you're looking at coccoliths, you might have to have a specialised microscope, which you would be looking at thin sections, and and also palynology. You need a special microscope designed for where you're shining the light through a glass slide, which has been prepared from a sample from a rock. But you mentioned scanning electron microscopy. It's quite an expensive technique, and it isn't available to everybody. We're really lucky here at the museum. We've got a whole unit downstairs where there are several scanning electron microscopes. So we can illustrate our material quite easily with that. And often you'll find in publications, things are illustrated by scanning electron microscopy. But one of the other things that people are doing nowadays, you pretty much go to any conference and you'll see a 3D rotating model of some sort of fossil, usually larger fossils than dinosaurs or some sort of large vertebrate. But we're also doing that for micropaleontology now, and we have the facilities here to do CT scanning, so we can produce a micro CT specimen that we can rotate and adjust and view. But the creme de la creme of 3D imaging is something called a synchrotron, where you can go to one of these rings and you can image down to submicron scale in enormous detail and produce these 3D renditions of things which are much less than a millimetre in size.
Are you planning on putting a particle accelerator in under the NHM?
Well, I've recently done some nano CT scanning, so we can use the scanning electron microscope we have here to produce images. And I recently posted online a nice 3D image of a planktonic forearm, one of our type specimens, a paratype specimen. But we've recently got a new SEM, and I'm hoping that we can produce even better images using that new facility. But getting a synchrotron in the museum, I think, is unlikely. I think we'll still be going elsewhere to visit those. But we do have facilities in-house to make pretty good nano and micro CT scans of our materials. But it is very time-consuming. We can't do it for all of the specimens that we have. We have to be very selective. Perhaps only take images of very few of our holotype most important specimens.
Yeah, so we've actually got that rotating 3D image on our website if you want to all go and have a look at that. So why does the Natural History Museum need a micropaleontologist, or indeed a micropaleontology department? I mean, it's not generally these small fossils that go on display.
Ooh, that's red rag to a bull. Well, let's start with the display side of things. You're absolutely right there. Because they're so small, they don't tend to go on display. But there are some images, for example, in the Images of Nature Gallery at the museum, of nanofossils on display. But the one example I'd really like to give is in the one of the recent galleries opened in the museum called the Treasures Gallery. And if you go in through the front door of that gallery, and the very first case that you see, there's a really beautiful glass model. It's a scaled model. It's probably, we think, multiplied by about 500 times. But it's a model made in glass of a Radiolarian microfossil. And it's absolutely stunning. And it's made by the father and son combination of glass workers, the Blaschkers. The particular model was made in 1889. But you mentioned them not being popular. they have at the end of the exhibition, there's a special display screen where you can choose your favourite item in the Treasures Gallery. And that, at the moment, that's number 2 to Guy the Gorilla. Guy the Gorilla's winning. But I say that's only because the voting thing is right next to Guy the Gorilla. Whereas the display of the microfossil, the 3D model of the microfossil, is right at the other end of the gallery. So people have wandered all the way through the museum's Treasures Gallery, and they still have that amazing image of a microfossil in their mind, and they voted for it on this particular display.
But that's contrary to rumours, it wasn't me going up there and pressing the voting button.
But that's still just a glass model rather than an actual fossil. So again, why do you need the fossils in the museum if they're not going to be on display?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, micropaleontology really is the backbone to a lot of other studies within the museum. It's one of the most applicable types of paleontology in the museum. So I've mentioned studies on vertebrates, ancient humans, I've mentioned dinosaur studies. You can also use them for fossil fish studies. A lot of the early fossil fish finds are dated based on microfossils found within the beds that those fossil fish occur in. So it's, in terms of the work of the museum, micropaleontology is pretty essential, I would say, to supporting a lot of work that goes on. And also in its own right as a subject, working on paleo environments, looking at ancient climates, it's particularly applicable to a lot of the real key work that the museum is looking to be doing at the moment.
So the museum's like involved in research and not just display?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that people are always amazed by when I talk to them about my job at the museum. As a curator, I'm behind the scenes, I look after the collections. Firstly, they don't realise that we have literally millions of specimens that people don't see. But secondly, they don't realise that there are a whole group of people behind the scenes doing research into those fossils, those fossil groups, and into paleoclimates and different things which are of real relevance to modern day society.
You said millions of specimens. I'm going to put you on the spot now. As curator, live, being recorded, how many specimens have you actually got?
Ah... This is a real bugbear of mine. Because if I were to get out a jar in my collection, I could put it on the table and say, well, how many specimens do you think there are in this jar? And there would be literally millions just in one jar. So the real answer to the question is we don't know. On the web, if you look on the website, it says the museum has 70 million specimens in its collection. But how do we know exactly? And what does that really mean? I mean, the example I just gave you was with the jar. Do we count all of those individual specimens as one? Because some of my colleagues might say, well, I've got a tray of 100 shark's teeth here. They're all identical. So therefore, we've got 100 specimens there. But if I were to do the same thing with my collections, I would be saying, well, actually, I'm looking after literally hundreds of millions of specimens here. So when we're working it out, we need to be really consistent about how we're counting these things. I don't think we really have so far. There are ways of doing it. I mean, you can say, well, actually, here's a drawer, and in each drawer there are 100 slides, and in this cabinet there are 105 drawers, and then we can multiply things up and make a sort of estimate that way. And I think that's the best way to do it. But then really, we need to be consistent about how we do this, and you know, the jar of specimens or the 100 varieties of the same thing, we need to be counting those in the same sort of way to really come up with a proper figure. So you know, I could go on for eight. I will stop now because I could go on for a long time about this, but because otherwise all the resources would come to me because I'd be saying I've got 50 million of the 70 million specimens in my part of the collection.
How do you keep them? You say that you have the jars of with thousands in. Do you not separate them out and say, here's an example of this species? Or do you say, this jar has got a load of sediments in, and in there you'll find the examples of this species? Good luck finding them.
Well, I would say the majority of specimens we have here have been individually separated out, and they're on slides so that someone's been able to identify them, put the details of the particular specimens where they were found. And these have been placed into trays and into drawers. So most of the specimens are individuals, or sometimes you have a slide where there are sort of tens or sometimes hundreds of individuals within one slide. So those are named collections, but we also have assemblages. So we might have a slide where you've got a representative of each of the species from a particular sample. But we also have, as I mentioned before, the jars of the residues where the material was derived from. So we've got sort of mostly individual specimens on slides, but also assemblages
and also the original samples from which those assemblages and individual specimens were picked.
So the advantage of that, I'm guessing, is that you're able to compare specimens quite easily and then also see them in their original context.
That's right. I mean, an individual specimen on a slide doesn't, it shows you something about if that's been used to define a species. That's quite an important thing. But often scientists will go back to the original sample or the residue where that individual specimen was picked, and it gives you much more context. It might give you context of the environment where that particular specimen was recovered or lived. Or it may give you other specimens which illuminate the original holotype specimen. So, because often when you're defining a species, you'll choose one specimen as the holotype, which will be the one everybody has to refer back to. But you'll also have another suite of specimens which may show the same sort of features or may show some variation in the original description of those particular species. And going back to the residues can really help with defining that type of question.
So who uses these collections? Is it just for you guys to do your research, or can anyone come and use them?
They're available to anybody on request. I suppose one of the issues is people knowing exactly what we've got, and what we're trying to do is to put as much information on the internet as possible so people can know that they're available for their studies. But they're used by people all over the world. They come to view the specimens and the collections here on a regular basis. And in a typical year, I would have roughly 220 visitor days. That was my last year's figure. We have to jot these down every year so that the government know that we're making the collections available. They continue the funding. But in my part of the collection, I'd say on average I have about 220 visitor days a year. So if somebody comes for 5 days, that's 5 visitor days. So we've got a large number of people coming through the doors, mainly scientists working on particular fossil groups. Most of our collections here are foraminifera, so most of the people are looking at that particular fossil group. But they could range across the whole of the fossil record and different fossil groups.
I was actually surprised to learn coming in that one of the groups of people that come in and view these fossils are actually school kids. And so we've got Sally Collins, who's a learning program developer at the Natural History Museum, to talk us through this. So how do the kids use these microfossils?
Well, what we do, we set them a challenge. We give them a sample of Gort clay. They don't know that it's Gort clay. And we say, you've got to work out the age of this clay. And they do a micropaleontological procedure. They wash it, sieve it, microwave it. And by looking at the species that are present and where their ranges overlap on the chart, they can actually work out that the clay itself is from the early Cretaceous.
So it's kind of like a simulation of what real micropaleontologists would do.
Yeah, exactly. We've tried to make it as authentic as possible. We want to do it in not too much more than an hour, because there's other galleries and activities a school group would want to do. So I worked very closely with the micropaleo team here to devise an activity that, whilst authentic, would work with a group of GCSE students in a very short space of time.
So what benefits do the kids get, or are you just trying to inspire the next wave of the next generation of micropaleontologists?
Well, we do sometimes on their feedback forms, they say, and it's always spelt wrong, I want to be a micropaleontologist. So we think there might be a spike in application. But actually, there's a couple of things we're trying to do. We're trying to inspire them about the natural world and about science and paleontology, and they are amazed that these, when they look at a sample that looks like grains of sand, that they're these beautifully complex organisms that they see down the microscope. But we're also trying to give them a sense of achievement in doing a real, inverted commas, scientific procedure. They position themselves as a scientist, and they do gain a real sense of achievement at actually solving the problem and working out the age of the clay.
So what other educational programs do the Natural History Museum run in paleontology?
I've got a huge range of programs generally, workshops, shows, lab procedures, specimen handling activities. Within those, with paleontology, we've got the micropaleontology workshop. We've got an activity which uses role play where students dress up as scientists. It's probably reinforcing terrible stereotypes. They have a lab coat, they have a clipboard, they roam the galleries. And to support the How Science Works strand of the curriculum, they gain evidence from all our amazing specimens in the galleries to make decisions about how various species of dinosaur behaved, ate, and related to other species in their environment.
So it's kind of like a dinosaur CSI then?
Yes, it is. In fact, we've got another workshop which we've actually called Dino Scene Investigation, where we are recreating a dig scenario. So, the students are digging out from a big box of sand a dinosaur. And again, they're using their interpretive skills and trying to make decisions and draw conclusions about that particular dinosaur. We have a paleo art activity which we run during our sleepovers, Dino Snores, which I named. I'm quite proud of that. But so what we're doing there is trying to show how artists, paleo artists, are actually using science to make accurate reconstructions, or as accurate as we can be, of various dinosaurs. So it's a really lovely workshop because we really are bringing science and art together.
But you do that in the middle of the night?
Yeah, literally. We did it last weekend. We finished our last one at 11:30. And we get 400 children maximum, all creating a piece of artwork which is actually on a t-shirt which they can wear with pride.
I can't imagine a better way to spend your Friday night.
I know. It's quite exhausting, and a lot of us kind of experience a sort of jet lag throughout the week, which we've kind of termed dino lag. But it's a lot of fun, and we really enjoy working those.
So one thing that Sally mentioned there is that these microfossils are actually really beautiful, and I feel pretty embarrassed about not having mentioned this before. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that, Giles.
The artistic and amazing beauty of some of the specimens that we have in our collections has often been inspiring to artists. And back in the day of Haeckel, when the radiolarians were made that were used as a basis for the glass models in the galleries. But nowadays, we, as well as having scientists come and visit our collection, we've had quite a few artists, and they could either be doing impressions of materials that they've seen or developing concepts based on materials in our collections, but also illustrators who are reproducing exactly some of the materials that we have in our collections. So this year we've had quite a few exhibitions which have included information or have been based on parts of our collections that we've loaned out from the museum here. So it's been quite exciting to go. For example, I went to an art gallery just around the corner from the Oval Cricket Ground, and I saw this beautiful, amazing full-size wall image of a radiolarian. It's quite remarkable. I quite like to buy one, but I don't think I can afford them. I don't think I could bring it home either. I might get told off.
So do you have a particular favourite specimen, species?
I think probably my favourite would be the Cretaceous ostracod from Brazil that shows internal structures. It's preserved. Usually microfossils, the organic remains decay pretty quickly after they die, and you just get left with the inorganic, so the silica or calcium carbonate remains of an organism. But these particular ones from Brazil preserved all their inner soft parts, including their sexual appendages. And we took this to the synchrotron in Grenoble, or Grenoble, however you'd like to say it. Get told off by French people for pronouncing it wrong. But this particular specimen, or these suite of specimens, showed that ostracods reproduced back in the Cretaceous in the same way they do with giant sperm, or using giant sperm as a method for reproduction.
I'm just trying to remember if we actually covered this in the episode of Russell Garwood on Carboniferous arthropods. I don't know if that made it into the cut or not, but we had quite a lengthy discussion about sperm and hemipenes.
Oh, ostracods. Everybody mentions that when you mention ostracods. Students love them for that reason.
So what are its statistics?
Well, their sperm can be up to 10 times the length of their body.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
You can't finish it like that.
Well, that's the thing, we asked all the questions, so I'm not quite sure how to finish it. So I hope that didn't bring back too many bad memories of the Naughty Step, Joe.
Not at all, really. Like, that was the time when we invented Paleocast. So it's what, a year, or just over a year and a half down the line, and things are really looking exciting for Paleocast now.
Yeah, indeed. Are you missing me, though? Are you missing my face? You just listen to my voice.
I miss your face.
I don't miss yours.
Well, I'll be seeing you shortly.
Will you?
At Progressive Paleontology. So this is a conference that Paleocast will be attending and will be live streaming, so you can tune in at home. And it's a conference for young career paleontologists. So that is master's students and PhD students from around the UK. So is anything else happening with Paleocast, Dave?
Yeah, pretty soon, on the 3rd to the 5th of May, we're going to be at the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival, and hopefully going to be recording some audio and a bit of video there. And they've got a whole host of things going on. They've got a whole fossil fair. They've got the Natural History Museum going to be there. The British Antarctic Survey is going to be there. They've got Horace, the Travelling Pliosaur Cinema. They're going to be making trackways. There's loads of things going to be going on, and we're hopefully going to be able to get some of that to you.
So, yeah, if you're thinking about attending the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival, and I thoroughly recommend it because it's the biggest fossil festival in the UK, then if you see Dave, and he'll probably be wearing his Paleocast T-shirt, go and harass him.
Yeah, I'm going to be there signing autographs if you want. T-shirts, whatever you like. I'll be signing fossils.
I'm sure people will be flooding up for that. So yeah, we'll be reporting from the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival, and we'll be sure to keep you posted. So stay tuned.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
And that's why it's my favourite specimen.